This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
As we've heard this week, after over 130 years, Sears filed for bankruptcy and is closing 142 of its struggling stores. But before it was known as a brick-and-mortar business, it was known as a catalog that reflected American consumerism and shaped American tastes. Lewis Hyman is an economic historian and professor at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. On Monday, he tweeted, "In my history of consumption class, I teach about Sears, but what most people don't know is just how radical the catalog was in the era of Jim Crow." We were intrigued. Lewis, let's begin at the local country store.
Yeah, in the 1890s, 1900, most African Americans were still living in the country. Not until 1960 are more African Americans living in the cities. And they lived as sharecroppers. They lived as tenant farmers. And when they shopped at the local country store. That was a place that gave them access to a wider world of goods, access to credit, which they needed because they were only paid once a year during the harvest came in, just like white farmers as well. Wow. But they had a very unequal access to the space. Of course, it was the era of Jim Crow, which started in 1890 in Mississippi.
Describe how that plays out in the real world.
The trick with Jim Crow was that it was everywhere all the time. And when African Americans would go into a train station, into a country store, anywhere really, they would have to wait until all white patrons were served first. When they were eventually got help in the store. Now, it's important to realize that the country store wasn't like stores today where you serve yourself, you go from aisle to aisle. Everything has to be done by a clerk at the counter who decides whether or not you actually deserve what you're asking for because it's all on credit. So the shopkeeper decides if you're the kind of person who should have that quality of shirt or not. And African Americans didn't really have much choice. This was the only place they could shop where they could get credit. So it was really a constraint, and every interaction was a rehearsal of Jim Crow, a rehearsal of hierarchy and deference, and, you know, treating black people like they weren't quite as good as white people.
And I was reading a piece in the Washington Post where they talked about white supremacy playing out in the way that you say. You didn't deserve the good quality shirt or the good quality flower at that point. In fact, it would be disturbing to think that a black person could have something in their home that's as nice as what you have in yours, say.
Yeah, and it's this sort of ritual, this play, you know, in clothes and food and hats and everything else. That really is what African Americans saw as so liberating in access to the catalog.
Right, because prior to the catalog, there was only the country store, right?
It was a monopoly. There was no alternative. And suddenly you could order things out of the catalog on credit, just like at your store, and they were cheaper and they were better. And most importantly, they were just as good as anything else that a white person would get out of that catalog.
And I think it's important to note that by 1908, one-fifth of Americans received that catalog. The podcast 99% Invisible cited a figure that suggests that at its peak, the catalog offered 100,000 items on 1,400 pages, weighed 4 pounds. And I wasn't around in 1908, but I was around in the 60s, and I remember I was excited when that catalog came.
Does fighting traffic when you shop almost make you blow your top? put an end to traffic fears. It's very easy to get to Sears.
And it could take many hours. You could leave it in the bathroom and just sort of browse it forever. Imagine, maybe that's too much information.
But just imagine if you had never left that plot of land in your entire life and you opened up this big fat tome and you could see what people in Chicago, that faraway town, were wearing and eating and buying for themselves, and just imagine yourself in a different world. And this is a time when, for African Americans, imagining Chicago was a politically dangerous act, that the Chicago Defender, one of the most important African American newspapers in America, was contraband in the South. You couldn't get it legally. It had to be smuggled from person to person, from church to church. And in a lot of ways, the catalog was like that as well. It was some sort of a radical imagination outside of the life you were told you belonged in and you would always have.
It shifted the power.
It shifted the power. And it meant that, you know, Black people could say, I'm just as good as you. I dress the same way. I eat the same food. I can have the same kinds of tools. I can even buy guns if I need to buy guns, which, you know, meant a lot in the era of the Klan. So this is something that is a pretty amazing intervention. You know, it's a very conservative impulse. Do I get the right to spend my money in capitalism, right? How do you argue with that?
Conservative with a small C.
Yeah. How do you? But at the same time, a very radical act when you're challenging a white supremacist order.
Now, you observe that the catalog was geared towards illiterate people, whether they were Swedish or African Americans. And so this is really more about a rural clientele than specifically about a racial issue.
Oh, no, there was a business reason. They were trying to sell to as many people as possible, doing a volume business at a distance in rural America, where most Americans live. Most Americans lived in the country until 1920. So this is trying to break the mold of all older business models, and they did it.
The Washington Post pointed to an article in the Libertarian Reason magazine.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? How Sears has been credited with the creation of the Delta Blues?
This is quite a claim, and historians have talked about this, that access to guitars,
steel string guitars from Sears,
cheap, you know, affordable, high quality, made this possible. And, you know, I didn't know that story myself, but, you know, it seems entirely possible that access to, you know, guitars are expensive. So, you know, and, you know, what a rich history to think about this sort of cultural creation that comes out of this catalog.
You described, we talked about a shift of power, how the general store in a place, which often also functioned as the post office, would sometimes refuse to sell money orders to Black families. And Sears understood that too, right?
Absolutely. So there was a huge problem where, you know, how do you submit an order? How do you receive an order when the store is also the post office? And white store owners were very serious about maintaining control. So what Sears did was put out orders that you could just talk to a postman. You could just skip the post office entirely. There were all kinds of ways to subvert that system if the postman was willing to get access to this national market and those national posts. And it was true for African Americans. It was also true for other groups that had a hard time accessing the catalog as well. People who didn't speak English, people who were illiterate, whether they were Swedish or German or whatever.
You know, what really shocked me was how acknowledged the subversive power of the Sears catalog was, that there were bonfires of Sears catalogs in places.
Absolutely. They had public bonfires. They set out all kinds of reward systems if you turned a catalog in and had it destroyed. You know, this kind of system of trying to defend Jim Crow in the name of small business.
But I don't get it, because plenty of white people, majority of the subscribers to the catalog were white.
The small shopkeepers would have preferred those catalog shoppers shop at their store as well. So, you know, there was a business side to it, there was a racial side to it, and it's hard to disentangle the two.
Now, at the time, there was a rumor that both Sears and Roebuck,
that's right,
were Black. It reminded me of anti-Semites claiming that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was Jewish. Sears himself published pictures of himself to prove that he was white. I assume that this was purely a business gesture, right?
Yeah, it was a business gesture. He, you know, white people could be convinced they shouldn't buy from black owners. But I think the larger question is it shows you how desperate these people were and how radical the catalog was and in that moment, and especially as the way it contested the racial order.
Which is really interesting also because it was back in 1895 that Roebuck sold his share of the business, and Julius Rosenwald became part owner of the company.
Julius Rosenwald's an interesting character because he was a small-time suit manufacturer, and one day Richard Sears walks in and orders 500 suits, and he's like, what are you talking about? You're never going to sell that many. And he says, I already sold them. And so that's how they got into business together. And Julius Rosenwald really helped him expand the business and helped him scale up.
And he was a huge philanthropist to the black community, donating more than $4 million, roughly the same as $75 million today, to open nearly 5,000 schools in the rural South where many African-American kids couldn't go to school.
Separate but equal was never equal. Separate but equal was always better schools for white kids. Mm-hmm. And these were schools that were good for black kids. And, you know, it's interesting because Julius Rosenwald was Jewish and he had a much more liberal political persuasion. He had this feeling of obligation to America, a country that had been good to him.
What other things did you learn from the tweet?
I saw that a lot of people shared their stories of shopping while black, especially young people being watched in stores, but also people who were trans talking about having access to clothes that maybe didn't fit their perceived gender identity and having that kind of lack of surveillance. So I think in a lot of ways, Amazon today is very much like the Sears Roebuck catalog of yesteryear. Also in the way it employs, you know, cheap labor. The Sears Roebuck catalog, the goods in it were made possible by the sweatshops of Chicago, right? And immigrants being exploited. So it's not the sort of an unambiguous story of positivity, but it is a story of access. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something to consider as we think about what digital capitalism means in the 21st century.
What does it tell us?
I think it tells us that there is real value in having access to markets, particularly for people who are confined spatially or economically. Certainly in the long history of America, African Americans have always been spatially segregated from other populations, and their financial and retail lives reflect that. So, you know, the classic study from the 60s, the poor pay more, that African Americans didn't have access to the same kinds of goods that white suburbanites had. And this drove a lot of the wealth inequality then and today.
Some 12,000 retweets of your original tweet as of this conversation. I'm sure there'll be more. Lots of interviews. Why do you think it resonated so much?
I was surprised. Obviously, nothing like this has ever happened to my tweets before. And I think I tried to tell a story that was positive. The story of how people simply used the catalog to fight against white supremacy.
And did you find that at all ironic? As a historian of capitalism, a student of capitalism, you've probably spent a lot of time staring down some of its fundamental flaws and injustices. And you've observed that democracy has long been constrained by racism. Is this a case of capitalism to the rescue?
It's certainly a case of market competition to the rescue. What's surprising to me as a historian is that Jim Crow faced down consumer capitalism and Jim Crow lost. And in the first Civil Rights Act, it wasn't about voting. It was about consumer access. It was about shopping.
How so?
Well, the first Civil Rights Act of 1963
was about equal access to stores?
Equal access to stores, equal access to trains, equal access to restaurants and hotels and movie theaters. I think for many of my students, when I teach this class, it's easy to not really care that much about voting. You vote every couple of years, but every single day you use a bathroom. Every single day you go somewhere. And to think about, oh, that is what Jim Crow meant. It's an everyday kind of thing.
It doesn't really bother you that Sears is falling apart, right? I mean, it's survival of the fittest. Amazon did to Sears what Sears did to the general store.
That's true. I mean, it bothers me in the sense that I worry for the workers, the hundreds of thousands of workers at Sears that are going to lose their jobs. But I do think that it's part of a broader reconfiguration of retail. And in the next few years, we're going to see that happen. The book I just released was largely about this reshaping of the American landscape and the insecurity of work. And I think that's the story that's here. Even as we want to focus on the consumer experience, we should also be focusing on the employee experience.
I mean, it may be that we all end up shopping at one company for, you know, the next couple of generations.
For a generation. I mean, that's what's sort of interesting. I mean, there also is a long history of how the chain stores took over. First the catalog, then the chain store, then the mall. There's been this succession of different kinds of retail in American history. And right now we're just at another crossroads. And so I think we shouldn't lament the death of one kind of retail. We should figure out how we can make this new kind of retail, this new kind of economy work for everybody.
I'm not so much worried about a new kind of retail as I am about one company dominating all retail online. And I say this as someone who has a Prime account.
Yeah, no, I think there are people who are very concerned about monopoly and monopsony. And
monopsony?
Monopsony is where there's only one buyer as opposed to only one seller.
Uh-huh.
So in America, Walmart is a monopsonist. They're the only buyer for a large swath of Chinese factories, so they can drive down prices and control that. Mm-hmm. And so we actually live in a monopsony economy right now. So Amazon, Walmart, and we're not talking as much about that as we can because it's such a strange word.
I love it. Thank you so much, Lewis.
It's my pleasure.
Lewis Hyman is an economic historian and professor at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations. His latest book is Temp: How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary.